3, 2, 1, 0.
From the studios of WORQ in Wisconsin, this is the Stand Up for the Truth podcast. Today's issues, overlooked headlines, and biblical observations, equipping the remnant around the globe. Got your sword handy? This is Stand Up for the Truth.
Good Friday, March 29, 2024. Fresh new podcast today on Stand Up for the Truth. Mary Danielson is back at the host mic, and a very special guest, one of our popular guests, according to the feedback we get on our website.
This morning we have Pete Garcia, and we're going to go around the world in 60 minutes and look at some hot spots. And when I read his articles and I realize just how it's all connected and intertwined and what could possibly happen, it's just an incredible overview, and so we're going to do that today. And it is Good Friday indeed. So our scripture this morning is Isaiah 53:4-6. And we are thinking about what Jesus did for us, even more so this weekend. We're always mindful, but even more so right now. And it says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, we have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." Would you pray with me this morning? Oh, Lord, we are so grateful that you have the entire sweep of civilization in your hand and that you give us, your servants, a glimpse into your eternal plan. Oh, Lord, thank you for sending your Son that we can be reconciled to you for all time and eternity. Your word tells us that you reveal your plans to your servants, the prophets, and we have the sure word of prophecy for these times. Oh, Lord, give us eyes to see and ears to hear, that we can warn others of these storms that are coming, and that we could see many brought to your kingdom by the power of your Holy Spirit. Thank you for Pete and for his desire to be watching and waiting and to bring understanding to the issues of our day. Bless him and his loved ones, his family, with good health and endurance. In Jesus' name, amen. Like I said, we're welcoming back Pete Garcia today, retired military combat veteran and aviator, writer, researcher, speaker, teacher of Bible prophecy and apologetics with a BA in international relations and a graduate of the U.S. Army's prestigious Command and General Staff College. He wrote for Jack Kinsella's Omega Letter from 2011 to 2018. He has written hundreds of articles that are carried on numerous websites and platforms. He has contributed written chapters to three Terry James books, and he has co-written two nonfiction books and published three of his own Christian novels. So he's been a busy guy. Rev 310. So I always want to just say it outright. Rev310.net, right? Welcome back, Pete.
Thanks for having me again, Mary. Good to be here.
I really want to encourage people to go to Rev310.net for some of the most really well thought out articles on world events and take in the videos. And not just today's article that we're going to talk about, but he has a three-part series entitled A Revolution in Prophetic Affairs. That's a real education. And I would actually take time and read those first, but we're going to talk about this one. So you're going to hear what's in this other one. It's called World War III, From Impossible to Inevitable. We completely passed over improbable, and we're going right for it, inevitable. And Pete, you start out this article with a graphic from a gentleman named Clarence Larkin, and he published many books over 100 years ago with charts that he drew in great detail illustrating events of the last days, long before we had any understanding of Israel, the modern state of Israel, let alone any technology. But he was one of the genuine dispensationalists of our time. He understood the main themes of prophecy, and he acknowledged the gaps in his understanding. And Pete, we still have gaps because we can't see into the future, but explain this graphic and why it's so timely, even though it's from 100 years ago. We have a prophet looking at the mountain peaks, but what does that mean, mountain peaks of prophecy?
Well, I think the great late Clarence Larkin had done an amazing job in just in highlighting the strengths and weaknesses in our understanding of Bible prophecy, as was his, right? So he looked in and was able to capture in an image that he drew just the dilemma that we face, because the Bible does present a very complete and exhaustive outline about things to come and in the order that they come in. But just as that prophet is looking over at the mountain peaks, he can't see what's in the valleys beyond the mountains. So he's, some of those things are hidden from his understanding. And some of those things would include, obviously, the age of the church or the dispensation of the church that has now stretched for 2,000 years almost. And in that, you know, I think this kind of came to mind back in 2020 when the pandemic hit, and I guess subsequently after that, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You know, experts, scholars, students, everybody was looking at how does this fit into Bible prophecy.
Right.
And so I've always kind of just... I keep getting drawn back to this diagram that Clarence drew because it so perfectly captures our lack of understanding. And it's not anything, you know, on us. I mean, it's you know, the tyranny of the present. It's it's all these different things that we face as a living in the moment and trying to see what's going to happen next. And so how do these things tie in with Bible prophecy? Well, I think there's a lot of things we can't specifically point to, like, for instance, with the Russia-Ukraine conflict. But we can see the implications from it. We can see what the results are, what things are coming out of it, and how that's shaping the prophetic narrative going forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's a perfect example what you give after you have that chart in your article about World War One and World War Two. People, the average person, now maybe the powers that be and the elitists and the Luciferians saw this coming, but we did not, because first with World War One, you have the assassination by a terrorist of the Archduke Ferdinand, and pretty soon all the monarchies have fallen across Europe, and Europe is up for grabs. They're gonna go back to the nation state paradigm at some point, which I believe is in God's plan. And then World War Two, so many different players. So many different problems, you know, the Czechoslovakian problem, the Poland problem, the Jewish problem, the Russian problem. And so we did not see those coming either. So that's a great, great, example that you give at the beginning. But, you know, we're looking at today, we're looking at Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, and South, I guess. And if you put them all in a high speed blender and crank it up, is that how we could define 2024?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think this year's far from done. I've been saying pretty regularly that this year is going to be a watershed year for geopolitical events in the world, and it'll be incredibly consequential regardless of who's remains in power in the United States, because that's going to drive a lot of other things.
Well, you mentioned something about elections. There are 76 nations facing elections this year. That's a lot of instability, Pete, because elections by their very nature are destabling. It can completely change a country. Hey, we know all about that here. I don't know what to do with all that, because that really is a wild card. What do you think about that?
No, I absolutely think that is a destabilizing event for half the world. You know, there's 193 nations right now. I'd say probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 or 15 are what we would consider failed states. They largely fail to govern themselves, so I would take them out of the equation. And so, but then you have the other half, the rest of the nations. You know, out of 193, if you remove 15, you're down to what, 178 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that, 76 of those are having elections. So, you know, almost half the world is having elections. So yeah, it's an incredible amount of turnover in the Western civilization, largely because obviously Eastern civilization, you have these despots like Putin and Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un and the Ayatollah, who don't change out power. They just stay in power forever. So for them, it's incredibly stable. For us, the world is very tumultuous and very, it's like the sea, as described in Luke's version of the Olivet Discourse, that the waves and the sea are roaring, and there's this distress amongst nations. So I think that's very apropos for our world today.
It really, really is. And in our nation, and I just can't believe the instability and the weakness that we have. And weakness is a huge problem, but at least our country is underwritten. It has or had a spine as far as the Bill of Rights and the Constitution to keep things moving in a certain direction. But Pete, that all bets are off with that. So a lot of the instability and the weakness comes from here. Have we ever been weaker? I don't think it's going to get better. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in terms of polarization, I don't think we've been at this polarized since probably 1859, 1860 time frame. I mean, certainly our nation's gone through some tumultuous times, but overwhelmingly the population was largely, you know, way more homogenous than it is today in terms of shared worldviews, Judeo-Christian values. I'm not saying they were all Christian, but just they had a basic understanding of right and wrong and citizenship and what America meant to them. And I think probably the knowledge was probably the average person's understanding of education, although on paper probably wasn't as, you know, we didn't have as many PhDs and masters and folks with BAs running around back in those days. But if you simply look at their education system from the early, you know, first half of the 20th century, I mean, their elementary grades and high school education was far more rigorous than what we have today.
Right.
I just think the basic understanding of folks was they were a lot more intelligent about the basics than we are today. So certainly the enemies of our system and the enemies that have been trying to overthrow this Judeo-Christian worldview and this constitutional republic we call America have spent the better part of the last half of the 20th century dumbing down the population and bringing all manner of ills and things to try and overthrow this system that we live under. So, yeah, I mean, we're just seeing the fruits of this blossom today.
Yeah, we really, really are. And you mentioned something, too, in the article about geopolitical weakness, and that certainly is here. Our military is not what it used to be. But it always invites aggression, you say, just as the policy of appeasement enticed Hitler to conquer Europe. So, too, will the current discombobulated rabble of weak-kneed leaders cause our adversaries to make the moves they think they can get away with? And there's another destabilizing factor, countries thinking they can do what they do, especially when it comes to Ukraine and Russia, and we can get to that later. But I think as far as even finding enough people to serve in this country is a problem, among other things. And appeasing China, good grief, that's the defining characteristic of this particular administration that we're in, from the little balloons, the balloons that were flying over a few years ago, to Cuba having China having a spy base in Cuba. I think our admin tells China one thing and tells the Americans something else, so that we just roll over and go back to sleep. But what about now? What other ways are we too weak to really hold our own anymore? I think this is a huge part of whether or not we're going to have World War III in our lifetime.
Well, there's I mentioned a list of issues that I think are causing the United States a huge problem these days. One is, you're right, we can't meet our recruitment numbers. There's a whole host of reasons for that, but the large part of that is that the administration, the entertainment industry, Hollywood, pop culture, have spent the better part of, you know, the last 15 years really demonizing white Southerners, men, to be more specific.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been the largest demographic that was going into the military.
Interesting.
That was serving. So when you spend all that time demonizing them and really creating policies that are hostile to them simply for something they had no control over, you know, what color skin you're born with, that's one issue. The other is that the military-industrial complex has completely gone off the rails. And so we're spending, tens of billions of dollars to create a jet, you know, or a tank or a this or a that. When those things become obsolete in the battlefield, they're hit with a whatever kind of weapon, that capital loss right there is huge. And so for the military industrial complex, they don't care. They've sold it to the government already, so they've already gotten paid. But like in Afghanistan, for instance, think about all of the what was it, $900 billion worth of equipment we left behind.
Wow.
Because in our justification, it would cost more to ship it back. I think that's a ridiculous argument. I mean, we could have given that to India. We could have given that to Pakistan very easily. But instead, they wanted to take the easy way out. And again, the Boeing, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, all these guys, they don't care. They've already sold it to the government. So for them, they've already gotten paid. Mm-hmm. They don't care what the government does with it at that point. But just the cost of attrition in terms of dollars, when our enemies this ties in with asymmetric warfare. So asymmetric warfare posits that you have one side of the battlefield has such superior fighting forces, equipment, everything, and the other side doesn't, and they have no way to match that strength.
Okay.
So they have to find alternative ways to fight. So when we came into Iraq and Afghanistan in the early 2000s, we came in overwhelmingly and very easily, and we began to take everything over. But how does that war continue with the guerrilla warfare at that point? They go low tech, and it takes us years to catch up. I mean, when you think about improvised explosive devices, just little bombs that probably cost $100, maybe $200, get buried on the side of the road, and then a MRAP or some other type of military vehicle drives over it in a convoy, blows it up, and it may not kill the people inside of it because we've hardened these vehicles now. But now you've completely shut down that operation, that mission they were going on for the day. Now the mission becomes just recovering that vehicle back to a base, and just the cost in dollars is way, way skewed. We have the superior fighting technology, but it comes with incredibly high cost. They come at it with a low tech counter force, and they are able to beat us. And simply, how much does it keep costing us to fight this battle?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're bleeding huge dollars. And eventually, they know that the governments won't tolerate that for too long.
Mm.
And neither will the taxpaying, American citizens.
Yeah.
When we look how much money we've invested in Afghanistan and Iraq, just to simply walk away, it's staggering.
Yeah, it really, really is. What was that number again that you said that the cost of all the things that were left behind in Afghanistan, what was the number on that?
It was like 900 billion or 900 million. Yeah. I can't remember which.
That's
it was
a lot.
Significant, I want to say it was billion.
Yeah, it's a
or
lot.
90 billion, sorry.
Yeah, okay. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's a lot. And I think it was John Haller I was talking to last week. We talked about drone warfare and some of these smaller countries with not so much gross domestic product can still afford the latest drone technology. It's gotten so much cheaper, and now you've got a whole nother level of warfare with drones, which changes the dynamic too. For, like I said, countries can afford drones as opposed to some of the more traditional weapons of war. So that's another interesting thing. Now, you have here in this article, and again, it's called World War III, From Impossible to Inevitable, summarizing the state of the world as it stands today. And I think this will help the listener a lot to get this straight in their heads. You have a concise overview based on research that you have done. And the first one, there are seven things here. The first one, U.S. division. And we talked about that, presidential election, potential for social unrest, civil war among, between Americans, the global stature of our nation at the time, election outcome and all that. The second one is Middle East tensions. Oh, here's another front. The potential for an escalated conflict there. It could at any day. I mean, we did not expect what's happened on October 7th to still be hanging on. We're still grieved about the hostages, but what is the potential over there with all the players going on? That could be it too, Pete. What do you think about the Middle East tensions?
Well, yeah, I think once Israel finishes Hamas, then I had written an article back in October 16th called Equivocation, talking about the U.S. response at the time. But it's largely played out, panned out as kind of the way I saw it back then. That they were only showing concern. I'm talking about the Biden administration was only showing concern so they could turn around and try and use this as A, exploit the crisis, and B, to try and control and manipulate Israel in the future war of this. But I think right now Israel, as they finish things up in Rafah, whenever they go in, once that's done, I think they're going to have to deal with the Hezbollah problem in the north. And so that's one of those things that's still hanging over their heads, and they're not going to simply just go back to peacetime operations.
Right.
They still have a large portion of their northern citizenry that are displaced due to the threat in the north. So I think they'll have to deal with that. So there is going to be an expansion in regards to their immediate borders.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure seems that way, and we never know when that's going to happen. But number three you have here is the Ukraine conflict. Boy, that's just, I think when Israel was first attacked, this took a back seat as far as the news goes, and now it's back on the front burner again with Russia using some missiles against them. And it's just, what do you see? Is it lost? It's so hard to even know what the truth is about what's going on there. So what's your take on it? I guess is my question.
Yeah, no, I think Ukraine is lost. Okay. And it was lost from the minute that the Russia decided to invade.
Hmm.
You're talking about, this is a great example of asymmetric warfare where you have one side that is completely superior in numbers, technology, weapons, etc. It would be like the United States kind of war against Mexico.
Mm.
The invasion would be incredibly quick.
Yeah, right.
Now, what they've resorted to is guerrilla warfare. That's largely been enabled by the West and by NATO through continued arms and armaments. And then they've done some surprisingly innovative things in and of themselves in terms of what they've done with drones and stuff. And I think they're using like jet skis out in the sea there, and they're just putting a little bit of the explosives on there, and they're ramming these things into the ships, the Russian ships, and they've been very successful in doing this. And those ships are designed so that their guns are pointed at the lowest those guns can point is at the horizon. So when these jet skis ram into these boats, and they have just enough explosives to cause it to be disabled. Nobody can really stop those jet skis. So they've largely stayed away from operating in those waters right off the coast of Ukraine. It's going to continue as long as the West continues to keep supporting it. But the minute that the dollars dry up, then I think that Ukraine's lost.
Okay. All right. I read an article from the AP recently. It says, Putin says he won't start a war with NATO, he says, but Western bases hosting Ukraine F-16s would be targets. So it says here, Putin scoffed at the possibility of his country launching an attack on a NATO member, calling it sheer nonsense, but warned that any Western air base hosting U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets that are slated for deployment in Ukraine would be a legitimate target for the Kremlin's forces. Is that his line in the sand? I think he would be gunning for NATO, if for no other reason, Sweden being added to NATO right on his backyard and that sort of thing. I don't necessarily believe anything he says, but how about you?
Yeah, no, I think initially that Putin's intentions in Ukraine were simply to regain the Donbass, mm-hmm. the Donetsk region there, mm-hmm. In eastern Ukraine. But it was also meant to make Ukraine a hands-off note. It would never join NATO because they don't want NATO right on the border. So, right. And that also begs the questions about the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, just to the north of Ukraine, who are part of NATO now. So I don't think that, like Israel having to deal with Hezbollah in the north, I don't think that this is something that Putin is going to leave hanging. I think he's going to deal with these issues, and he's been pushed to the point where any little thing that triggers or trips his red line, whatever that is, I think this can escalate very quickly into a much larger conflict.
Wow. Yeah, we really are on the verge of even more instability than we're already seeing. Sweden and Norway, that's the other one, their accession to NATO. Russia says they will send troops to the border if that happens, and, verified that. That's how it works. So that wouldn't surprise us if he did that at all. So the Ukraine conflict, number four, and an overview based on 2024 so far, technological and AI governance. It's just developing so quickly. I've almost stopped trying to keep up with it, Pete, because I was digesting it at first, and now I just have thrown up my hands, and I think the unforeseen potential with AI and China hackers, there's an article in Gatestone, I think I sent it to you, China's unrestricted warfare, is it here already? And it says China-linked hackers appear to be looking to attack U.S. infrastructure, especially key components such as the electrical grid, water reservoirs and treatment plants, pipelines and transportation and communication systems. And that's about all of it. But it says their goal is to disrupt the U.S. everything in the U.S. that's critical to life. If you have no electricity, your cell phone won't work, no water will come out of the tap, gas pumps will not pump gas, flights, trains will stop, and disease from disabled sewage treatment plants will spread. There will be havoc and panic. Talk about World War III. You know, no bullet being fired. They didn't need to. So this is another area of warfare that could disable us completely. Do you think China would do it all at once, or is this going to just be a slow hack, or what do you think their plans are?
Well, I think the lay out the scenario in the four steps below that section is, I think these would be kind of a chain reaction.
Okay.
That when one thing happens, it triggers the next and the next and the next. So, the Chinese, the North Koreans, Iranians, Russians have been hacking into the U.S. for years now, and it pretty much it's becoming so commonplace now. It's just something that it's a new normal for the 2020s, and so there is a, in my estimation, they have battalions worth of guys, and all they do is just hack. I mean, that's all they do is try and hack into things. And so, that to me is an example of gray war, where it is an act of war that's really just below the threshold of conflict, below the threshold of what, like a declared war. And so these ongoing aggressions are destabilizing, and I think that they would be ramped up very much if the U.S. did anything that would be counterintuitive or counteractive to their agenda. So yeah, I think that this thing can be ramped up. It's like a dial. I'm sure they can ramp it up and ramp it down as necessary. Yeah. So since they control these battalions of PLA hackers, so.
Wow. Well, we could wake up any day and find that something that we really rely on is down. And then you have social media and the internet lighting up with all everyone's theories and on what actually happened, and we may never know, but we can certainly understand the potential for this kind of craziness. Number five, you have your China slowdown. How are things over there? Are they in a recession? What's up with them monetarily? I mean, they have a Western-style economy, but it's still a communist government. So how do we parse that out?
Well, the U.S. and Great Britain and a lot of countries in the West, their wealth, they grew generationally, meaning they, through trial and error, learned how to create systems of market and commerce and finance that have, within those things, built safeguards and safety nets and structures and all that to help guide a more stable economy. China's wealth has largely been relatively overnight. I mean, it really wasn't until the 1990s, once they got the most favored nation status changed in their favor, to now become one of the world's leading producer of goods and services. But all of that technology that they have, say most of it, is through either corporate espionage or through reverse engineering things. So, like, for instance, we send a manufacturer decides to send a widget to China to produce because you can make it cheaper there and then sell it back to the Americans at a lower cost than if it was made here in America and Americans made it. However, the Chinese also get blueprints of those things, and then they make their own version of copy of that thing. So,
Interesting. Pete, we're really out of time for this segment. It went so fast. I can't believe it. And we have so much more to talk about. I'm talking to Pete Garcia today, Rev310.net, and his article, World War III, From Impossible to Inevitable. And he has some points here on the state of the world today. And then we're going to switch gears in the second half and talk about how World War III will begin in four steps. And I think we've seen already just the different fronts, even a simple thing as half of the world's nations having elections this year is very destabilizing. And then there are so many other points past that. So, again, Pete Garcia, go to the website. A lot of great, great articles. And we're going to take a two-minute break. And we're going to be back with so much more about the geopolitical scene here in 2024. Stay with me.
Our social media pages are shadow banned. Thanks for your prayers and sharing our posts at standupforthetruth.com.
Welcome back to Stand Up for the Truth for this Friday. It is Good Friday here in 2024. We're talking to Pete Garcia, Rev310.net. So many great articles in there. Pete, you have a lot of upcoming events. You have some conferences you're speaking at in April, May, and June, it looks like. Bet you're looking forward to those.
Oh, yeah.
One in Mississippi, and where else are you going to be here? Mississippi, Oklahoma, and then there's a Colorado Springs. So people can go on the website and look at those and see who the speakers are. So we're going to get back here to World War III, from impossible to inevitable. We've skipped over improbable completely, which makes perfect sense to me. But you have a concise overview of 2024, and I want to make sure that we finish that. Number 6 out of 7 global conflict hotspots. And, you know, we're talking, even Haiti is definitely a hotspot. But what else do we have going on, Pete? What are some of the other hotspots that could go at any time?
Well, obviously, northern Mexico, you've got a number of cartels there that are all vying for power. So they've introduced a huge amount of instability and carnage for the last 20 years into northern Mexico that will have to be dealt with at some point. And I think whoever the next president is will probably be drawn into a conflict with securing or stabilizing northern Mexico. Turkey wants to repatriate or really take over the rest of Cyprus. You've got issues right now between the government of Pakistan and the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Wow.
Obviously, you have some of these, the other shoe waiting to drop issues like China repatriating Taiwan back to mainland, and then North Korea wanting to reunify the Korean Peninsula. And then I threw in there one, too, also about Islam, in particular with Iran. Iran wants to basically bring the whole of the Muslim world under their tutelage, under their authority. And the way they can do that is by taking Mecca and Medina and then controlling Saudi Arabia's vast oil reserves. So that is a possibility.
Wow. North Korea, that's interesting, because North and South could not be any different when it comes to technology or anything, really, when it comes to being a global player. If China goes after Taiwan, and that's a real possibility, will that include North Korea attempting to go after South Korea?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. And because, one, you know, when I look at when you read articles from the experts in the different think tanks, and they're looking at the conflict, let's say they try and measure NATO versus Russia, and they look at this kind of in a bubble, in isolation. I don't think that conflict would happen in isolation. I think it would very much that the nations that are mentioned in the Iron Coalition, that being, you know, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, these are nations that have largely been under Western sanctions and embargoes for a number of years. And not so much China, but now China's kind of falling into that same, it's this kind of this cold war mentality we have with them, because we do recognize them as adversarial in pretty much every metric. They, you know, they're trying to undermine us. So I think that when one thing happens, it will trigger the rest. And when it does trigger the rest, I think this is how NATO will be toppled, and NATO will come apart. And then that will force the Europeans basically to have to restructure and redesign what was NATO into some kind of Europe-specific military force that will go into the last days.
Wow. So we're talking a European standing army at some point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, their population, they have more people in Europe collectively than we have in the United States. They're like 500 million plus. So, and then they have huge unemployment numbers for the younger folks. So, there's not going to be any shortage of people to conscript once they decide to go that route. But the way things are at right now, I mean, you've got the United States in the number one position in terms of geopolitical superiority. And then number two and three has kind of been back and forth between the EU and China. I would say China, just because of their military prowess, is puts them on as a near peer to the United States in a lot of regards. Yeah. Not everyone, but definitely they're head and shoulders above where the EU is specifically. So, yeah. But, you know, I think that's got to change. The United States has been this giant roadblock, really, for global government going forward,
mm-hmm.
you know, just due to our constitution and the way our government's structured. Mm-hmm. That we have to be removed first in order for this global government to come about.
Mm-hmm.
So until we're out of the picture, this thing is still going to be hanging there.
Very interesting. And Europe is a new thing in the world, actually, because it's a supranational government where there are sovereign nations, but they're governed by a particular, you know, European Commission, the powers that be there in Brussels. That'd be like Africa, all these nations having its government, an African government. And so this has not been seen. So it's nation states, but it's not. I really think that's just a last day's side issue there, a side sidebar for whatever it's worth, kind of a freebie this morning. But you talk a little bit, and I want to go back to this, the EMP possibility for the Korean Peninsula and Korea, North Korea taking, because North Korea, I did not know this, more than 60% of North Korea is not even electrified. The transportation networks of the two Koreas are very disparate as well. And South Korea, 97% of the roads are paved, while North Korea, only 8% of the roads are paved. I had no idea. And so you think, well, how could they take South Korea? That seems kind of silly. But you mentioned an EMP. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so, you know, any one of these nations in and of themselves would be loath to simply try and declare war against the world, which essentially any of these moves would be considered by the United Nations and others. But I think that when one thing happens, I think it will do this again, this cascading event, where now it triggers this next thing and then this next thing and this next thing. So the third thing in this issue was North Korea. Once China makes the decision to take Taiwan, well, let me back up a little bit. So if Europe is provoked into a wider scale European conflict, right now all of NATO, all of U.S. forces, all of the attention would then be simply placed into one area, one focus. I think what the only chance that they have between Russia and China in doing the things they want to do is by dividing up the Western forces into multiple fronts. So this is where this China makes their move on Taiwan once Russia decides to expand. And at the same time, we've known China for a long time has held the leash on North Korea forever.
Right.
Since the 1950s, they've been their biggest benefactor.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at this point, then China could divide the Pacific theater, which is what it will become, into two. Now you've got U.S. forces, Western forces devoted to protecting Taiwan or defending Taiwan. And then now they're also having to deal with a North Korean invasion over South Korea. And so every dictator, every despot knows to play to their strengths. And so, and that's why I included this image of the map of the Korean Peninsula at night. You can see this huge difference between North Korea and South Korea in terms of their electrical grid.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, you know, devil's advocate here. If I were Kim Jong-un and I'm looking at this photo and I'm thinking, okay, how can I defeat such a highly advanced adversary? Well, I would do what the Taliban and the insurgents have done. We go high tech, they stay low tech.
Hmm.
And the biggest thing that he has that he could do would be to launch either launch a missile or use those satellites that he currently has two in orbit right now. But I think one of them or both are armed with this low yield nuclear devices on their warheads. And they could detonate that thing at altitude. So it would need to be about 300 miles up in the air. And that would completely shut down South Korea. And so now South Korea is on the same level playing field with North Korea in terms of technology. And not only would it hit North Korea or the Korean Peninsula, but it would also hit portions of Japan and then in China there. But, you know, I'm sure North Korea would say, hey, this is what we're going to do, prepare ahead of time to the Chinese, and so they would take their appropriate measures, but everybody else would be a surprise. And so now North Korea detonates this thing. Oh, they could even do it over their own airspace because it's going to hit the whole peninsula regardless.
Right.
And in South Korea, their military forces, a lot of their equipment and a lot of the American equipment there is hardened. against an EMP up to a certain degree. But 99.9% of the civilian infrastructure there would be completely disabled. And you talk about panic and chaos and just, I mean, it would throw South Korea into a tailspin that they could not recover from. So, and so now, not only is North Korea, you know, that would be at play, but also all of the Korean Peninsula falls under the short-range missile launching umbrella that China has. So that would limit the amount of response the Americans could do in terms of flying in or sending boats or naval assets to support Korea, because now, you know, we're basically at war with China. And in the second graph I have up there, it shows the range of all China's missiles. So we do have a ton of resources in the Pacific. And the way that China deals with that is they divide that into two different forces. And now that is the third time that these forces have been split. So you go from Europe and Russia to now Pacific theater operations. That's splitting Western forces in two. And then you take the Pacific theater and you divide that into two. And now you've got two different conflicts going on, all under the threat of a missile attack by the Chinese. And it becomes very, very incredibly less likely the U.S. is going to be successful in what they want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you make the best case for World War III that I have ever heard, because this is so multifaceted. It's like a multi-level chess, and who's going to blink and who's going to move next. I want to talk a little bit about economics, because, you know, we have such terrible inflation in this country and people are having a hard time making ends meet. And the Bible talks about hyperinflation in the tribulation period, loaf of bread for a day's wages, that sort of thing on a global scale. And I'm fascinated to tie this into a country like North Korea that really has no infrastructure. Haiti has some. I mean, Haiti has internet and that sort of thing. But there are spots in the world that really don't have a digital infrastructure. And yet I see that in Revelation 13, where the whole world, of course, the whole world after some of it's been annihilated, probably due to wars and that sort of thing, but and plagues and pestilences. But how do you see this playing out, and how are economic situations, how is hyperinflation feeding into world war, and that sort of thing, global economies, as we're going to the Great Reset, they want CBDCs and all of that. Is there some way we can parse this out in just a few minutes, Pete?
Yeah, I mean, desperate times make people desperate, and just like the crumbling and failing Weimar Republic at the end of World War One, you know, who are under the Versailles Treaty and all these other kind of economic sanctions and repatriation programs that really crippled Germany from ever recovering. Mm-hmm. That same population were the same ones to embrace a little unknown guy with a funny mustache named Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist Party. So I think around the world, as we see hyperinflation and all these things wreaking havoc on the economies, it's going to cause people to embrace more desperate leaders and desperate programs to try and survive, or more radical, rather. So I think that all ties into it as well. But ultimately, I think that globalism, wherever it's tried, it's failed. And so the kind of happy medium where they're going to split the baby on this is they're going to advocate for regionalism, so that the world, and this is after the end of all these conflicts and stuff, they would advocate for breaking the world into 10 regions. Mm-hmm. And then in these regions is where the little horn, this guy from out of nowhere, rises up, just like Hitler rose up out of nowhere. This Antichrist guy will rise up out of these 10 regions, and he will be the one that ends up taking over three, and then he'll end up controlling the whole of the global infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Great answer. And when we look at the history of Germany, and they did recover. IG Farben, you know, the pharmaceutical giant cartel that Hitler controlled was split up, but the people that were responsible really for the most deaths in World War II were not punished. And these mega corporations now rule the world. And how Germany was able to recover, talk about history repeating itself, is they came up with the Deutschmark, and the world recognized the Deutschmark as that currency, and that enabled them to recover. So I think we can look at history and see patterns. There's nothing new under the sun, and the enemy just wants to keep promoting his his ascension to power to be like God and to rule the world and to destroy humans made in God's image. So that's a great answer, and I think that is exactly what's going to happen. Now, you have here how World War III will begin in four steps, and I want to make sure we get to this before we run out of time. And those four are, number one, keep poking the Russian bear. Number two, China makes its move. Number three, unleashing North Korea. And number four, the Iranian dream. You mentioned the sites of Mecca and Medina, and Saudi and Jordan are administering those and the Temple Mount right now. I don't see that continuing to happen. Out of these four, we have covered some of each of them probably. Out of these four, what would you like to say? Have we left anything out on those four particular ways that could trigger World War III?
Well, I think when we see any one of these begin to happen, I think that because these nations are all very closely aligned together, the West has pushed them into this very tight corner where now they largely are all reliant upon each other. So when you attack one or you provoke one into a course of action, I think the rest will follow. And I think all of this ties in with the ultimate formation of Gog and Magog conflict we see in Ezekiel 38-39. And that war is still yet future, but the players that we see there are Russia, Iran, Turkey, and then there is a whole host of nations that align with Russia, presumably all the former Soviet satellite states of Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, etc. And then you have some African nations that also join in the fray, and those are modern day would be Libya and Sudan and probably Somalia and Ethiopia in that area. So I know Russians have been very active in Africa as well with the Wagner Group. So I would not be surprised to see that at the end of this World War III scenario, what's left standing there is going to be this Gog-Magog coalition. You'll still have China in play, and then you'll still have Europe trying to rebuild its forces. But everywhere else is going to be largely kind of out of the game at that point.
Wow. Yeah, those Persians. They have a conventional military comprising 587,000 active duty soldiers plus another 200,000 reserves. They have the Islamic Republic of Iran Army, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. That's the one we hear about the most. The Law Enforcement Force. They're Shiite. Is that correct? Iran is Shiite?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And so Sunni is the majority in the region. Do I have that right? I think I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they have Shia militia forces in Bahrain, in Iraq, and then they also have their close ties to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. So they're surrounding Saudi Arabia in terms of loyal forces to the Shia branch of Islam. But I think the biggest thing for Iran is that the Abraham Accords is really a wake-up call for them to...
Yeah.
They're losing. They're basically on the threshold of losing this Muslim antagonist position against Israel. So there are Muslim nations out there willing to normalize relations with Israel, and I think that Tehran is not going to let that happen.
Okay. You mentioned the Wagner Group, and if I remember right, the gentleman who was the head of it, who was we were just starting to learn about it and him. I believe he died. Suddenly, yeah. So they're still going strong. They must have someone else in place there. Is it a suspicious death in your mind?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think it was a explosion in the flight, the plane crash or whatever with him. But yeah, it seemed suspect, or the kids would say sus today.
Another point here you make in the article, you talk about Poland emerging as a significant force in mainland Europe, aiming to build a 300,000-strong army with modern tanks, artillery, and fifth-generation fighter jets by 2030. That's a long time from now, and I think things are going to blow up in one front or another way before then. I did not see that coming. I did not expect Poland to be involved in that, but... they're working with Germany, again, to bring back the draft. So Europe, we definitely want to watch Europe. Wow, there's just, Pete, like I said, there's just so much to look at here. I had another note here on something about Germany, and I can't find it. So that's fine. So I think we've covered just about everything. You said that two out of four of these were going to have some real issues on the world scene. So, question, what do you think about nuclear war being in a scenario that when we talk about World War III and we talk about nuclear-armed Iran and Israel and the U.S. and Russia, what are you thinking about the threat of nuclear war in all these scenarios?
Yeah, I think people have kind of, you know, at least from the prophetic community, have written off World War III simply because it's always been tied with nuclear war.
Right.
I think the case I'm making is that we can have World War III without the nuclear option in there, because we have certainly enough weapons and different kinds of weapons that could be equally devastating without destroying the planet in the in the process. So any type of nuclear exchange, everybody knows this, is that it would be the onset of nuclear winter, and that would basically start killing off a huge number of people on the planet due to starvation and famine, all these other things. So I don't think anybody wants to go that route. And I think the only kind of nuclear action that we may see in all this is with North Korea detonating it just for the EMP effect over their peninsula. So I see EMPs in play. I don't see nuclear, the traditional nuclear exchange of ICBMs, et cetera, between major nations, because that basically everybody loses it, and nobody can survive that. So
Wow. Now, if an EMP were to be released, say, over North America, that would pretty much, would you say, destroy our infrastructure for many years into the future, or are they not quite that powerful, just enough to distract, or what would be the result of an EMP over North America?
Oh, it would be catastrophic.
It would,
It would also depend on the altitude at which it was detonated, as to how far wide that circle would be over. If it was detonated over the center of the United States, it would be catastrophic. But I think it's certainly a possibility going into the future that that will be the likely, just because of how dependent everybody's become on technology, it seems the most likely choice of weapon for the enemy to hit you where you're weakest.
Sure.
And so, anyways, I think that this will all happen sooner rather than later, simply because there are so many different factors coming into play that's going to make this option for the Iron Coalition, it's going to make it increasingly harder for them to do what they want to do if they wait any number of years. Just like with the case of Poland, they're only going to get stronger militarily, and that presents a far more significant challenge for Russia going forward.
Wow. Yes, I think we've made a case, Pete, that the world is very unstable due to so many different factors. And you mentioned in your Revolution in Prophetic Affairs, Volume 1, you say the reason war always changes is that the enemy gets a vote. So you can have all the plans in the world of how you're going to carry out an incursion or some kind of military action, but no plan survives first contact with the enemy. So let's just add that, war is unstable as it is.
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, we have about a minute and a half left. It went so fast. A little bit longer. A minute and a half. That's what we have left. Anything else? Did we leave anything out, Pete? Anything else that you feel is something that we should be watching for?
Well, obviously, as watchers waiting for the Lord to return, and, students of Bible prophecy, all of these scenarios are incredibly frightening because they don't paint a sunny picture for our future. But as believers in the Lord Jesus Christ, we know that our future is bright, in the fact that he is going to come back, because he promised to come back to return for his church, and so we know that that's going to happen sooner rather than later, given the fact that even though we can't see signs for the rapture, because it has no signs, we are seeing signs for the buildup of the 70th week or the tribulation time frame. We're seeing signs for the Gog Magog conflict. All of these things that happen after the rapture, we're seeing them start to develop in our day. And so I think that should invigorate us as watchers to get busy about the Lord's work and doing what he's called us to do in these last moments of the last days.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I love about your articles is it's big picture stuff. And I think we can get bogged down with politics. We can get bogged down of just the distractions, the distractions in America, the distractions in the news. But I really encourage people to read this, World War III, From Impossible to Inevitable, also Revolution in Prophetic Affairs, Volume 1, Rev310.net, all kinds of articles and videos, and also Pete's upcoming events. If you live in these areas where he's going to be speaking at a conference, you can get that information on that too. Thank you so much, Pete. We really, really appreciate your time. Enjoy your time with your family and keep looking up.
Amen.
All right. God bless. Monday, a replay, Stand Up for the Truth, and Mike Gendron on Tuesday, Brady Blevins on Thursday, again, and a replay on Wednesday, and some headlines on Friday. That's what's coming up. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you've been blessed and edified and built up in your faith. God bless you this Easter weekend. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Have a great day on purpose.